Accuse Senator Bundy, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dyson, Senator Olson, Senator Stedman, and Co-Chair Wilken for joining me today to hear three different bills. March 14th, right on time. And Senator Wilken, do you have any?
No, ma'am. Thank you.
Announcements? Okay. Anything going? Okay. The first one is Senate Bill 303, the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority, which is sponsored by the Transportation Committee, and I think it's going to be carried by the Rules staff. Are you carrying the bill, or is George Wirch and Bill Green? Come right on up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is George Wirch. I'm the chairman of the board of the Kinnick Arm and Bridge and Toll Authority, and I'd like to start this morning by commending the legislature for passing, which is clearly one of the best toll authority bills in the United States, and you did that in 2003. Nevertheless, we have learned in the last 3 years that there are some improvements conveyed to this bill, and what we have today before you is pretty much a housekeeping thing, catching up with the times and lessons learned around the country, and responding to one specific requirement of the original legislation, which is to come back to you and establish a debt ceiling in terms of dollars, and that ceiling proposed is $500 million. I am accompanied today on my immediate right by Bill Green, who is counsel for the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority, and hopefully on the telephone is the Attorney General's representative, Jim Cantor. Jim, are you on the phone? Well, perhaps you'll call
not
in
yet.
Later. Jim is the chief of the transportation section for the Attorney General, statewide chief, and he has been monitoring this project from the very inception. I'm also accompanied by Deputy Commissioner Tom Botan of the Revenue Department, because Tom is one of our board members designated in the legislation as a chair for the commissioner, and Commissioner Corbis has assigned Tom in writing to represent him. Department of Transportation is represented by John Manley, who's in the chairs behind me, and all of these folks are available to answer any questions the committee might have. So without further ado, Madam Chair, I would suggest that perhaps Mr. Green give a brief overview, and then, depending on your wishes, he can go through section by section, or perhaps more efficiently, just respond to questions of the committee.
Thank you. Bill, you want to introduce
Madam
yourself?
Chair, thank you, members of the committee. My name is Bill Green. I'm project counsel for the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority under contract with the Attorney General's Office. Mayor Wirch hit the highlights, and I would just like to make a few emphasis. Last week, I furnished each of the staffs with a presentation packet. I hope you have had a chance to take a look at that. If not, it's probably before you. The packet contains a statement of the purpose of the bill, a sectional analysis of the bill, the text of the committee substitute, the current version of the bill, and then it contains a copy of Alaska Statutes Chapter 19.75 with the amendments provided in the bill inserted into the statute, so you could see the whole statute and see how it would be affected. Those inserts are in blue to show you how the bill fits into the statute itself. In 2003, this legislature created the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority to build a bridge across Kinnick Arm, linking the Matanuska-Sitna Borough and the municipality of Anchorage, to improve the transportation system and infrastructure in the Upper Cook Inlet, and to support the growth and development of the state of Alaska. As Mayor Wirch has said, this bill changes what is generally considered to be an excellent toll authority statute. During the last 2 years, particularly, as Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has investigated, has prepared its EIS, has talked to financial consultants, has talked to other state DOTs, to other toll authorities, to Federal Highway Administration, their transportation infrastructure, Finance and Innovation Act section, which provides subordinated loans for infrastructure projects, and some significant conversations with experts across the country in the private and public financing sectors. We've come to be aware that the financing sectors requires a great deal of specificity and a little bit more than what our statute provides in terms of the Kinnick-Arm Bridge and Toll Authority's underlying statutory authority to enter into financing arrangements both with the federal government, with the private sector, with partnerships, financing partnerships of various kinds, and of course, last but not least, the bond market in terms of issuing revenue bonds. So the ultimate result of that investigation and study was the bill that's presently before you, and it is fundamentally a housekeeping bill. What it does is to clarify, make specific the specific authorities and powers of the Kinnick-Arm Bridge and Toll Authority so it may proceed with obtaining necessary financing. As you all, I'm sure, know, thanks to our congressional delegation, particularly Representative Young, there is federal money available for this project, but regardless of the amount of federal money that is available, and it's always been understood that private sector money and other public-private partnership financing would be necessary to fund this project. Accordingly, we've responded to the suggestions and recommendations of the private sector as well as other public sectors in the Federal Highway Administration to provide amendments to the current statute to make specific and to underscore the authority's powers to engage in various and sundry financing arrangements. The bill provides exclusive authority to Kubota to set the amount of the bridge tolls, which provides the stability that the financial markets demand. It also is explicit. The amendments are explicit in providing authority for Kubota to enter into public-private partnerships for equity financing and debt financing as well, to authorize the obtaining of non-recourse loans from Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act, which is TIFIA, Federal Highway Administration Program, and provides various and sundry means by which the Kinnick-Arm Bridge and Toll Authority may collect tolls and revenues it's due for operation of its toll facility. The one significant substantive provision, as Chairman Works has mentioned, is the provision which sets the dollar limit for the amount of revenue bonds that the authority may issue. In the existing statute, it simply says that the authority must come back to the legislature to get that authorization, and to obtain the authorization is part of one of the major purposes of the bill before you. I'm prepared to go through the bill and to take you through the sectional analysis if you like, but you've had that. I suspect time might be better spent, but I leave that to your discretion, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'll be glad to try to answer whatever questions you may have.
Before you do that, I would I know in one of the Kubota meetings we talked about the reason for needing this. What shortcomings or inequities or lack of authority or purpose did you find that you specifically needed? I know the TIFIA language status is required through a federal agency, is it not?
Yes.
And that's at the bottom of page 2.
Yeah. Madam Chair and members of the committee, what we have here in these word changes, this housekeeping adjustments, are lessons learned from other toll authorities. And as the chairman just pointed out, the Federal Highway Administration has this new financing program, short named TIFIA, where they provide loans or lines of credit or investment equity to projects. And the problem that they have confronted in the last 3 years is they get ready to give a toll authority a check, and that toll authority, for one reason or another, would get sued, and the cases would come up that said they didn't have explicit authority from their state legislature to borrow from the federal government. So the TIFIA staff has just simply said, if your state legislation doesn't mention the TIFIA program by name, we won't accept your application. So we would like to ask you to put the TIFIA program in the legislation so we can talk to the Federal Highway Administration about borrowing. Similarly, in the private sector, and I'm going to use an example closer at home, this is the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. They're building a second suspension bridge in Tacoma alongside the original, well, not the original, but the existing bridge. And they were ready to sign a contract with private investors. In this case, it was the Bechtel Corporation and Peter Kiewit Constructors. And on the eve of signing, they got sued by some folks who opposed the project on the basis that the state legislation did not give that toll authority explicit authority to enter into private, public-private partnerships. And, of course, they lost because they didn't have it. So what we're asking you here is to give us the kind of language that has been proven to be acceptable before other bodies as appropriate delegation to enter into public-private partnerships. And similarly, many of the other language changes are just from lessons learned. These amendments, however, have been circulated and approved and include the comments of the state's bond council, the State Department of Revenue, the State Department of Transportation, the State Department of Administration, as well as our own findings. So you have here a compendium, if you will, of all of the advice that we've been able to gather in the last 2.5 years, plus the specific authority for $500 million in debt. Let me talk briefly, if I may, Madam Chairman, about the whole financial picture. Again, you've watched the media, we have a $600 million project. The governor has submitted to the legislature a recommendation that the Kinnickarn Bridge project received $94 million in the federal funds, and with that will come a match of state money, which is typically about 9%. So that gives us, in round numbers, about $100 million. We have to raise $500 million to close this financing gap. And preliminary discussions are that that's probably doable. If we find in the next 12 months it's not doable and we need more public money as a down payment to that huge mortgage, we're going to have to come back next session. But right now, we believe we can move forward and find that private financing. Toll revenues for this project, even at a $3 toll, indicate a revenue stream over 30 years of $1.5 billion. So we think we have a revenue stream that will justify financing the $500 million that we're asking you permission to borrow. And hopefully we can deliver to the citizens of the state of Alaska a $600 million project or a $100 million down payment.
So the provisions in here put you in line to more easily arrange for funding, borrowing, and security for the project.
That's exactly correct, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Are there questions that anyone might have to this point? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question goes to the state's liability if, in fact, Kubota is unable to pay back the $500 million in debt when it sells the bonds. Would not the state, as a result of the language being asked here, be financially liable for those dollars?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that's an excellent question. And if the chair would allow, I'd like the Deputy Commissioner of Revenue to respond because he is the caretaker of the state's bond rating and credit rating. So if Commissioner Botan would come forward.
Welcome, Tom.
Howdy, Tom Boutin, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. This is a through the chair, Senator Hoffman. This is a typical revenue bond, standalone revenue bond structure that you would see not just in Alaska but in other states. We would all hope and expect that anything with the state of Alaska name on it wouldn't default, and to the best of my knowledge, that has never happened. There are protections along the way in this revenue bond structure. There'll have to be a feasibility study by a nationally recognized consulting firm that deals solely in, typically at least, solely in toll road projects, and they'll put their seal of approval on there being adequate money to fund a debt service reserve and to fund operations and to meet some revenue bonds tests that will be in the indenture as approved by the Kinnickahn Bridge and Toll Authority Board. Typically, there'd also be a financial guarantor that would sell financial guarantee insurance, which doesn't protect the issuer but protects the bondholders. This is a revenue bond structure that is very similar to the International Airport system revenue bond structure, which has gone to the bond market about 20 times since 1969. And that structure, of course, relies upon the rates and fees charged for the two airports. I hope that answered your question, Senator Hoffman.
No, I understand the airport connection and the $3 that is being proposed here, but for whatever reason, you know, it's whatever reason it might be, if Kubota is unable to pay back the debt, the $500 million that we're talking about, will the state of Alaska be liable for those dollars?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the bondholders would not have a legal claim through the bond indenture or the bond prospectus, called official statement, or any other bond document. The bondholders would not have a legal claim on any state resources apart from the bridge and its revenues.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Very good. Senator Sevin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the financial layout of the bridge, is there any mechanisms put in place to protect the purchaser of those bonds? Are they going to be guaranteed by other mechanisms?
Tom, would you answer?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Stedman. Probably financial guarantee insurance would be purchased out of bond proceeds, and that's a purchase of a AAA, if you will, is what that is, and the structure in public finance is that then any one of six or seven financial guarantee insurance providers would research the documents and the feasibility very carefully, and so I would guess this would be an insured deal, just as most of the International Airport Revenue Bond deals. Well, all of the recent ones, but most of those have been insured. So that protects the bondholder, if you will. But the protections are in using a revenue bond structure that the public finance market has come to understand and accept, and to be able to only pull the trigger on the bonds after the due diligence that would be envisioned in this bill is done.
Thank you. Senator Bundy.
Along these lines, but only loosely related, I guess, is that the tolls are anticipated to cover operating costs. Should the tolls not cover operating costs, I think it's fair to speculate then the state would be under a great deal of pressure to subsidize these operating costs so that the bond companies are going to come and repossess the bridge or that the bridge would set idle. I think that's fair, though, is it not?
If I may respond, Madam Chair, Senator Bundy's got a very important point, and that is how do we make sure this facility continues to serve the public and it is maintained properly? And clearly, as a toll authority, that's our asset. So the toll authority would want to make sure that is done. But nevertheless, We are engaging already in conversations with Department of Transportation as to where that parting line is between where the State Highway Department takes over and where the Bridge Authority takes over. We don't have an answer yet, but I will point out that, again, the governor has asked in his amendments to the capital budget to put some money in there to pave the far side, the Mat-Su Road to the Port McKenzie, which is the road that will serve the bridge. Now, if those projects go through, and that is already a borough road, and the borough has entered into a sidebar agreement with the DOT that after it's upgraded, then DOT would take over that road. Well, that's 13 and a half miles of road that a state DOT takes on, as it does today, then as the borough does today, then that would be a little less that the toll authority has to do. Similarly, we might talk about what's done on the east side approaches. But the structure itself and its appurtenances are clearly a responsibility of the toll authority. But that's a good point, and it's one we're paying a lot of attention to, Senator Bundy.
You know, I also want to mention that if we get into a series of questions that have nothing to do with the changes to the Kinnickerm Bridge and Toll Authority, please remind us, because sometimes we tend to revisit history and we want to know how this happened. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the first opportunity I've had to ring in on this particular project. And so if I could stray a little bit from the bill, but it does, my questions and concerns do come back to the bill. I'm generally supportive of the Kinnickerm Bridge concept. I think it's our charge here, and I think we all try to think not of ourselves and our current generation, but those that follow us. This is a project for the next generation, and I'm generally supportive. But I have a problem here. My problem is that there's a firestorm in Fairbanks, and the Interior delegation is burdened with the thought, with the notion, the perception that these monster bridges that have attracted so much attention are going to be built at the expense of the generation of roads, or the roads that will serve our next generation in Fairbanks. And I can tell you with all seriousness that this is, if not the major problem in the Interior delegation is faced with this year, it is one of the top. So having said that, I need some help from you folks, from DOT, from the governor's office to explain to the Interior delegation and to others why we would do this at the expense of the rest of the state. So a few questions, if I could. It's my understanding, and there's some confusion, spin, however one would like to characterize it. Up until July 13th of last year, I was operating for the last 9 years since I voted to name the bridge in Ketchikan, the Ralph Bartholomew Bridge. I think, as a group, were understanding that these bridges would be built with what has been known in the past as additive money. Somewhere around middle of July, that changed, and that became deductive money. And suddenly, the money that we would normally spend across our state became, it's a four-letter word, earmarked for these bridges and all the firestorm that developed nationwide. So correct me if I'm not correct. Those monies that came to Alaska are part of our highway allocation, our formula, just as any other state in the nation. And they come to us as part of the formula for this legislature and government to allocate as we see fit. So if I'm not correct, I'd like to know that. So maybe that would be my first question. Are we all in agreement that the money comes to us in toto, and we have the obligation, the responsibility to divvy it up as we happen to see fit, as we have in the past? Is that?
That's to the chair, that. Senator Wilkin. You know, we could discuss some of the finer points, but the bottom line is the state of Alaska, you as a body of the legislature, have entire authority to do anything you want with these funds. The finer points is that they're not formula dollars, but you can treat them as formula dollars. The state DOT has decided to do that, and has submitted to you their plan to do so. In the governor's proposed budget, where $94 million is his suggested funding level for the Knick Bridge, is a representation of that decision. So, simple answer, yes, you have full authority to treat these dollars any way you want.
Okay, thank you, Mayor. About 6 weeks ago, we sent a letter to the commissioner and essentially said we're not going to be able to support these projects until we get some sort of a financing package, a pro forma, if you would, on how this project would be built, funded, and supported by whatever revenue sources are available that don't take away for the next 5 years the monies that would be available to build roads for the next generation in interior Alaska. This bill here, I would say, is deficient in not having that, and I've yet to see that financing package. And I think that Senator Hoffman and Senator Bundy are concerned, as I am, that if the bonds aren't sold, if they can't be supported by a $3 toll that I've understood could be as much as 12 or 15, then it's going to fall back on the state, and we're going to be sitting here with foundations and the expectation that we fund hundreds of millions out of the monies that should go elsewhere. So we don't need to get into it here, Mayor, but I would ask that, again, that a financing package be shown, and so you can look out how this is going to be supported to build the project and not at the expense of the rest of the state roads. Let's see, I think with that overview, I just have one specific question about the bill itself, if I could.
About what?
The bill itself, okay. If I could. On page two, line 8, it appears that, and I don't have a bit to this, but it appears that inclusion of paragraph 8, Mayor, does that say to me that when the Kubota was originally put together that you didn't expect any federal money to come? Or why do we need to put in the line that says incur indebtedness and accept lines of credit from FAHA? Did we not have that in the original, that authority in the original
Madam Chair,
authority?
If I may, I'll ask Bill Green to respond to the question.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator, you're referring to line 8. Which version of the bill are you looking at?
I'm looking at Yankee.
You line 8 or section 8, Senator Wilkin?
Page 2.
Mm-hmm.
Page 2, line 26, paragraph 8.
Okay.
Oh,
okay.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. To answer your question, Senator, yes, in my opinion, the bill did have adequate authority as originally written for incurring indebtedness, but as we previously mentioned, as Kubota has gone around the country and talked to financing experts, both in the public and the private sector, to TIFIA, the Federal Highway Administration, to the bond market, bond council, they've all come away with an advice that, particularly with number 8, where it mentions TIFIA, we've been told that needs to be in there, or TIFIA will not consider an application for subordinated debt. But they said, the main problem we see in most statutes we deal with on financing public projects is the statute are not sufficiently precise and explicit to give us assurance that there's not going to be an unnecessary argument over authority. So the point of both this particular section, as well as most of the other amendments, is simply to provide that clarity and specificity that the financing markets have requested the statutes and recommended the statutes contain. And this would then allow Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority to go to the financial markets, to develop a financial plan, to bring to the table private investment and subordinated debt, as well as the bond revenue, in sufficient amounts to fulfill the need for financing this particular project. So I hope that answers your question. If not, I'd be glad to try again here.
It does, sir. Thank you. Madam Chair, thank you for allowing me to just a little latitude on the bill.
We'll talk later. Senator Sinman.
Oh, no. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, you know, when we sit here and set policy for statewide infrastructure, we need to look far beyond our own district and any particular impact that may or may not have in our district. And in this particular issue, when we concern these two bridges, there was a presentation put forward by the Department of Transportation in November or October, in my opinion, to set up the political agenda to show impacts that were unrealistic and are not going to take place. And that showed impacts from Dixon Entrance to Nome in all of the House districts for multiple years. Now, the TILU bill puts in an extra $112 million more than the previous T21 bill. There has been some movement and some changing of positions from the DOT and their flexibility. These funds for the bridges are not surface transportation program dollars, and they're not national highway system formula dollars, and they do not come under the allocation of the 52% change. They are they reside in the Highway Priority Projects Program, the Bridge Discretionary Program, and the Transportation Improvement Program, and the National Corridor Infrastructure Improvement Program. So one of the first things we face when we deal with financing these bridges is get a clear and accurate representation of what we're faced with. And my understanding from, with all due respect, Senator Wilkins' interpretation of a political agenda driven out of DOT in October is just incorrect. And we have the responsibility to sorting through this stuff. Now, we have, in our office, have contacted Ledge Legal and Ledge Finance to help us unravel this. And I'm just not going to sit here and play a shell game with these guys. We've got some information from our delegation in Washington, D.C., that's in contradiction to the interpretation of DOT, and they've worked that through DOT, and they've come to an agreement on most of it. But if we go forward setting policies on political agendas that are driven deep in the bowels of DOT, we're never going to get anything built. We won't get a bridge in Ketchikan. We won't get the Connect Garden Bridge. We won't be able to keep the highways open. So I think we have the obligation with these major projects at this table to sort this out. And Madam Chair, at your convenience, we can start that sorting process at any time.
Thank you. We are attempting to do that now if we can get all the players at the right place at the right time. But I do want us to get back to the what this does. This is mainly, primarily, a housekeeping bill that prepares Kabata to go and talk to TIFIA and to private lenders, bond folks, and to move forward in that. And are there any questions on any of the amendments in the legislation or anything that anyone would like further explained? One of the questions we had in, I know staff had asked is on page 2, paragraph 7, line 21, issue and refund bonds. Is refund bonds, is that the same as refinancing? Okay. And I know on page 3, lines 10 through 18 or so, does this give Kabata the authority to keep all revenues and purchase assets not related to the bridge, or is it simply related to the bridge and that your authority?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I totally understood the question, but
okay. Does the authority given to Kabata in lines 10 through 17, does that rely strictly to the toll facility and the bridge and nothing outside of that? someone had just asked the question, does that give you authority to reach out and hug the next area, or is it strictly for the...
Madam Chair, these are, in fact, this entire statute is related solely and exclusively to the bridge.
Thank you. That's the answer I wanted. Okay. Do other, for Tom Bhutan, do other authorities or state of the state have this same authority? Does this bear any similarity to the railroad?
I would have to get back to you on that.
Okay.
Mr. Green might know, but I do not know.
Madam Chair, of course, as this committee knows, the railroad is an entity of the state. It's a state agency, so to speak. It's an highly independent corporation. This is similar. The railroad, I'd say, has a little bit more independence because it's more of an operational facility. This is more of an infrastructure facility. While there are operations, obviously, to it, you know, the bridge would not be, you know, carrying on day-to-day business other than maintaining and making sure the bridge operates and is open to traffic. But
okay, go out X number of years after the bridge is finished and all, and you're raking in more money than anyone can count. Where does that money go?
Go ahead. Well, on behalf of the board, the revenue, right. The surplus revenue.
Fairbanks.
Yes, Madam Chair, I think I hear at least one voice at the table has a suggestion. No, the money would remain with the toll authority, and that is to fund future improvements, expansions, or maybe even major repairs if something should happen.
Are there other questions? Senator Bundy.
In other words, Madam Chair, the bridge wouldn't give us a dividend any more than the railroad does. Madam Chair, just for the record and my understanding, as you've said, this is a housekeeping tweak. By passing this legislation, we do not commit any federal funding to the construction of bridges anywhere in Alaska.
No, we don't. This does not do that at all. I do have some folks. Is there any more testimony from the three of you? Just a second. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. You know, as I look at this bill here, and I'm not sure who to go ahead and direct it to, was wondering, how do you go, does this bill allow the authority to go ahead and change the toll rate that's there? And if it does, how do we know that $3 for the toll is going to be something that's been looked at and can be substantiated? Because if you look at something like the Whittier Tunnel, looking through the testimony that was there before, there was originally proposed that it was going to be $1.50 to go through there. And when I went through there a month or two ago, when I came down, you know, for two vehicles, it was $12 a piece. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden we see a tenfold increase in there, and some of these projections seem to be, you know, weighed in the balances and found wanting.
Through the Chair, Senator Olson, excellent question, because one of the things that lenders and investors are worried about is who can tamper with the revenue stream. This housekeeping amendment before you makes it clear that the only authority for changing or setting or amending the toll structure is the board of the Kinnick-Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. And that is one certainty that the investing community wants to know. Who can tamper with the revenue stream? And that clears it up. Now, is $3 enough? I will be bold enough to tell you today that I don't think so. We did the $3 toll model assuming that we would have about $400 million in public money and borrow only $200 million. We hired an excellent firm, one of the top three or four in the nation, out of New Haven, Connecticut, to do that initial estimate. Things have changed. We don't have the earmarks. We don't see a significant component of state money here, which is understandable with all the other demands you all face for funding. So we went back and we said, what can we do? And the thinking today is, with $100 million, as I put it, is the down payment, we can find a mortgage for the $500 million to get us to $600. And so we ask your support of this bill, and because it sets the framework from which we can talk to potential investors and lenders, and that's the next step in order to answer Senator Wilkins' question about where's the financing plan. We need this bill so we can go develop the financing plan, if you will.
Last question, Madam Chairman.
Yes, sir.
as you look at the financing plan, obviously Kubota has been talking about $200 million that it was going to go ahead and bond for originally, which is roughly a third of what you've projected the project to be. As you look at the $600 million project and have proposed that as the amount to go ahead and build it, I guess there have been other projections that are out there, some of them over $1.5 billion. And it brings into the mind something that Director Bhutan brought up, which was the idea of cost overruns, and he brought up the what happened there with the airport, international airport bonds there in Anchorage, where all of a sudden we're dealing into hundreds of millions of dollars of cost overruns on just a project that had to do with refacing essentially the terminal and putting a new wing on there. How do we make sure that, well, when my constituency calls and says, how do I know that the money that's there is not going to build a bridge halfway across, and then all of a sudden with declining revenues in the state, and those kind of issues, no more money's out there, and you got this dinosaur that's halfway across Kinnick Arm and is an eyesore, like some of the other DOT projects that have happened in the past, especially in calling into mind the highway up around Bettles. How do I comfort my constituency that this is not going to happen?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that's the question that the board wrestles with every time we have a meeting. Do we have a good fix on the cost? We believe we do. We've hired three extremely competent, well-recognized engineering firms to estimate the cost of the bridge. We've taken an economist's view of population growth and demand. We've looked at other factors such as the increasing cost of steel and concrete. And we've come up with a revised estimate that says this $600 million still looks very firm. And it includes almost $100 million that just sheer inflation contingency or contingency to meet unexpected. So we're not trying to go this on the cheap. In fact, if anything, we're trying to develop a financing plan that will be satisfactory for any of the all worst possible conditions, because we don't want to see the situation you've described of getting halfway there and not being able to finish. That's not an acceptable alternative. And I do want to pick up a comment of Tom Bhutan, Deputy Commissioner Tom Bhutan, because the investment community is not going to plunk their money on the table unless they're absolutely certain. So this is an additional assurance, if you will, over and above what a regular public works project has, where the decisions are made by people around a table. In our case, the decisions are going to be made in New York and in Los Angeles or San Francisco and the financing community. It may be an international investor. So those decisions are going to be far removed from the dynamic of a committee or a legislature. They're going to be made by investment professionals that do this every day of their life. And if they don't see this as worthy, we're not going to get a penny. So that's the strength of toll authorities around the world today, is that they are exposed to the most severe scrutiny of investors. And we have this number, $600 million, which we can defend and show the details for, which includes a substantial contingency, and we think that's a good number.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Wilkin, you have another question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Mayor and Mr. Green, if we could look in page 10. Line 20 through 24. It has to do with if someone has an unpaid toll or a fee, that after 30 days, if it isn't paid within 30 days, then they're barred from obtaining a driver's license, vehicle registration. I might suggest that perhaps the 30 days might be a little strong, and you may be setting yourself up for your bureaucracy that you don't need or want. And suggest, Madam Chair, that maybe that would be 60 days or 90 days. It's really easy to go 30 days overdue. I do it all the time. But if after 60 or 90, I mean, there's a definite intent, either it's lost in the mail or somebody just doesn't plan on paying it, and that's the time I think you would bring the hammer down. So I just ask for your comments. You'd think it would be a problem if we changed that to 60 or 90.
Madam Chair, we certainly have no objection to moving it up to 60, although this is not an issue in our proposed amendments. This is the original statute that decided. Oh, no?
These are the new provisions online.
Okay, I'm sorry, I take that back. 60's fine.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. And that would be in line 19?
Line 22.
So do you want to make an amendment?
Sure. Madam Chair, I would move, ask unanimous consent that on page 10, line 22, version Y, that the sentence read after 60 days in place of after 30 days.
Is there objection? It will be 60 days. Thank you very much. We have a couple of people online. Steve Wallace, do you have anything that you would like to testify to? If you would introduce yourself, please.
Yes, Madam Chairman. My name is Steve Wallace. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm one of two owners of houses on Erickson Street in Anchorage on Government Hill. And my interest, although it may seem sort of counterintuitive, has been in seeing the process go forward expeditiously, because in the event that the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is going to come and take my property, I'd like to see that happen, because in the meantime, I've been sort of economically transfixed by this process. In the hottest real estate market in the history of the nation, I believe I can't sell my house. And as a result, I've been forced to participate in watching over what the process has been. Over the last year, once they came out and declared the Erickson Street corridor as a preferred access route and then going through the EIS process. So I looked into what's been going on, what the proposed routes are, and I noticed in looking at the legislation in 1975-011, which is the purpose of the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority's enabling statute, that the purpose is to build a bridge. And so the place I'm going to go with this, Madam Chair, is simply in trying to scrutinize what the costs are that are anticipated here and whether or not those are realistic expectations by the Toll Authority. Mayor Wirch, has said that there's backup for those financial expectations. But I've noted in my efforts to try and research this that I can't find a particular study. It's just a declared number on the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority's website. I did find an HDR study, and HDR is one of the engineering companies that's been employed by Kubota, but they did a study for DOT in 2003, in January, and it came out, and the proposed cost for the bridge spans between 1.1 and a high end of almost $1.9 billion. It occurred to me that the $600 million figure for building a bridge appears to be one without any roads or infrastructure on either side of the Kinnick Arm. And I note, as the words are carefully imparted to the committee in support of the bill, that they're talking about a $600 million project, and that there'll be the expectation that other roads may be built up to the bridge as an approach. But the real question, I think, that's left begging is, how much money is it going to cost to put together the entire project? And I was impressed at the joint House and Senate Transportation Committee in Wasilla about a month ago to hear one of the members respond to a public member, Ms. Kilkenny, who was testifying about the Seward Meridian roads, which hadn't been produced following a vote to fund them through a Garvey bond, I believe it was. And one of the members of the committee said, you have to be careful if people promise you about building roads. It seems that we don't have the infrastructure for the bridge, at least at $600 million, as a cost, and that there's a real expectation that the money is going to be much in excess of that that's required to make the project viable.
Yeah, Mr. Wallace, do you have any comments about the piece of legislation before us today?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Could you get to that, please? Because we're kind of on a time constraint.
Certainly, Madam Chair, and thank you for your indulgence. The bill here is to render the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority more financially independent. That's the stated purpose here. And while it's said to be a bill that is going to simply be a housekeeping matter, it seems that it is important for the committee to look at what the underlying predicate premises are for the expected cost before giving that free range through the financing ability of by enabling Kubota to have sort of a free hand. They'll become completely independent and not subject to legislative oversight. That's what I have. Thank you very much, Madam Chairman.
Thank you very much. Jim Cantor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jim Cantor. I'm the supervisor of the Transportation Section in the Attorney General's Office, and I'm really here to help the committee answer any questions.
Okay. Are there any questions of Jim Cantor, the attorney from the AG's office? Okay. Thank you, Jim, for being with us today. Stephanie Kessler?
Hi. This is Stephanie Kessler, and thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to beg your indulgence just for a moment. I happen to be in San Jose in a convention center, and I've tried to find the quietest spot, but there's still occasional noises that go by, so I'm apologizing in advance. Anyway, I wanted to follow up on Senator Olson's concerns and the concerns expressed by Mr. Wallace. I think that the Finance Committee and the legislature as a whole has a fiduciary obligation to understand with some level of confidence the true cost of the bridge. The mid-80s study and then the 2003 studies that were just mentioned put the cost of the bridge between $1.1 billion and all the way up to $3 billion if you look in the mid-80s study. Yeah, this bridge is projected out at $600 million, and what I was suggesting is that we would want a fair comparison between the current proposal and the past proposals. What are the differences? Why is this bridge estimated so much lower? What's being left out? Where are the differences? Is anything underestimated? And we have yet to see, as Mr. Wallace mentioned, I think Senator Wilkins has also mentioned earlier, we haven't yet seen the financing package. We haven't seen, even at a mid-level, the cost projected out and what is going to be involved with these, with the $600 million estimate. And so I think we need to have a hard realistic understanding before we can commit the state to these bonds and the financing package. And so as we consider this bill, I would ask that we consider it in a larger context. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Stephanie. Are there any other questions? Does anyone have any reason to hold this or want any information? Senator Stedman, motion please.
Madam Chair, I'd like to go ahead and move CS for Senate Bill number 303, version Y, as amended at the table today with attached physical notes and individual recommendations.
Is there objection? There being no objection, Senate Bill 303 moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached physical notes. Next up is 304, Airport Parking Shuttle Airport Charges. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me this opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Ryan McKinster. I'm staff to Senator John Cowdery, and I'm carrying this on behalf of the Senate Transportation Committee. Currently, under Alaska law, there's a commercial vehicles that deliver people to the airport are charged a certain fee for basically using the privilege of curbside service. Depending on that vehicle's classification, they are charged different fees, ranging from $50 per car to year up to approximately $1,000 per vehicle if it's a scheduled bus service. At present rate, these rates are charged by Department of Transportation for different vehicles, specifically for use of the curb, and basically under statute are required to be charged by be reasonable and uniform for the same class of service of privilege and to with due regard to property and improvements used and the expense of the operation by the airport. basically, for the most part, all services, whether you're a bus or a small taxi, you're using the same service. You're using the on-ramp, drive up to pick up passengers and to leave, and the privilege of sitting there and waiting for passengers. In early 2005, Department of Transportation proposed a change to regulations, which would charge off-airport valet parking services a separate fee of 8% of their gross revenues, which is vastly different than the other services that are being offered, the fees they're charging. But these off-airport parking valets are using the same privilege of the airport. They are basically pulling up, offering someone a ride, giving them a ride back to the parking lot they have, which is off-site. It's not on airport property. But instead of charging them $50 a vehicle, as a courtesy vehicle is for a hotel, they're proposing to charge 8% of their gross revenue. This, in effect, would raise their rates from approximately what they're paying now is a little over $1,500 to over $100,000 a year. Basically, this bill asks a change be made requiring that all services that use this taxi or this, privilege of pulling up to the airport be charged a reasonable and similar uniform rate. Statute currently says that, but it is the Department of Transportation's contention that the off-airport parking is a different service and they're using a different privilege of the airport. But the committee's belief is they are using the same service and they should be treated as such, charged the same rates as other courtesy vehicles.
Other questions? Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's a matter of speculation, I suppose, but being the off-airport parking competes with airport parking, is that does that play in this equation?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, it's the sponsor's a belief that may be part of the problem. Another issue brought up by DOT that is their consideration, even though they're not the direct person responsible for this, it could raise some fees for concessionaires on property and the ramp fees to cover for this revenue they expect to get from off-air parking. But the intent of the bill is to make equality for all. Even though they are directly competing with the airport, they should be treated the same as other airport services.
And so logic would probably say that if there is then some additional costs incurred, perhaps everyone that uses the curb should have their fees increased.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy. Yeah, I believe the idea is whether or not you agree with the certain rates that are being charged now, they're too low or too high, they should still be equal for all similar services. I think that's the contention of the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As we look at this bill here, or the consequences of this bill, I guess, does it play into any federal regulation that are dealing with the international airport there that may or may not have some guidelines or some outright regulations that will affect this?
Senator Olson, through the chair, not that we know. We haven't seen anything in regards to any federal change or any requirements by this. This is specifically under the authority of the airport as in state statute that allows them to charge this, and they're not required to charge something more. Basically how some of the things, the bonding issues and technically the new bonding issue for the parking garage proposed, or the private parking garage with rental services in it, those the ramp fees are have to cover those bonding fees, and so this may be attempt to alleviate some of that cost. But it's the intent of the committee that shouldn't be used, some off-air parking shouldn't be used to make up for those fees for something that's actually on leased property.
One last question, Madam Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Are there any additional maintenance costs that the airport incurs because of these off-airport businesses that are not incurred with the on-airport, on-site?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't know if those are any. The airport hasn't mentioned, the Department of Transportation hasn't referenced any specific charges that cost them more for this. And in that whole view also, there may be some, but the contention of this is if there are some, they should be even for all people that are off air. Whether you're a hotel with a shuttle or you're a person off air parking, you're still using that curb for 5 minutes and using that concrete. So the rate should be reasonable between the two entities.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How do they do it? Let's just use, how do they handle this at, say, Seattle or other places around the nation? This isn't the first place this has happened.
Senator Wilkin, actually, through the chair, some airports actually charge different fees, some similar to this, some higher. Some places have, there have actually been court cases saying it's acceptable to charge percent of gross sales for off-air parking and other services. But that's outside of our current statute that requires, basically it requires a uniform and reasonable rate for the same class of privilege and service. So it's out of this specific jurisdiction of our statute. Their statute was different than ours. So the other statute do require the language of reasonable and uniform for the same class of privilege and service. But there have been court cases in other airports saying it's allowable to charge percentage of gross sales for off-airport parking.
In another state?
In other states.
Follow up?
Thank you. No.
Senator Dyson?
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I suspect the committee chair and myself have small entrepreneurs who run shuttle services to folks, significant distance from the airport who drop, schedule, and pick up, deliver passengers. And, they've had some concerns about the rate structure they pay. Is the legislation that we have before us in any way affect those folks or alleviate any of their real or imaginary problems?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, it doesn't, it basically limits it. They won't go up to this percentage of gross sales if that was it. If they were offering a parking service, say it was in Eagle River, and driving people in, they would technically fall under this proposed regulation of 8% of gross sales. I don't know if that actually occurs in your community. I think it would probably be a good idea. But basically, this limits it from that. So it'll protect them on the up end. It doesn't deal with the fees that are currently in place, except for the fact that it requires a reasonable and uniform fee for similar services. So it'll keep them in line with a separate group. It'd make it harder for the airport to target a specific group and raise their rates out of proportion to other groups, which does give you some bargaining power. You could say as a group that if one person gets picked out and says, we're going to raise your rates to $100,000 a year, it's harder for that person to stand up for themselves compared to a group that says, this group of six businesses are going to get raised that much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Looking at the fiscal note, and you referenced it earlier, there's a possibility of increased cost between $150,000 and $200,000. It's a little hard for me to imagine that there would be that much wear and tear on a curb. Do you know, was it discussed where this cost came from? Was that loss of parking revenues due to the competition, or were there actual wear and tear costs?
Through the chair, everybody. Actually, there is no cost. It's basically loss of anticipated revenue. That revenue stream doesn't exist yet. This is a proposed regulation, so that $150,000 they're going to take from the parking off valet parking, that revenue stream does not exist yet. So it wouldn't be a loss of actual revenue currently from what's currently happening.
So it's the old, a decrease of an increase is a cut.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Are there other questions? Senator Wilkin.
I've been thinking about the question I had earlier in the response. So if I'm Diamond Parking and I'm going to decide to put a parking lot wherever this is, I think I know where it is in Anchorage, I do a business plan and I have to expect what sort of user fees are going to be there. So let me go back and ask again, could you get me please the structure under which Diamond Parking operates in Portland and Seattle?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, I'll be glad to get that for you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions of the sponsor? Okay, we have a couple folks offline and Mike Neely in the room. Mike Neely, would you like to come forward and testify, please? If you could give your name and who you represent, please.
I'm Mike Neely, and I am representing Diamond Parking. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Go ahead.
I want to thank you for allowing me to testify on this bill. I'm the regional vice president for Alaska for Diamond. The situation has come up over the years that we're currently facing this 8% of gross sales charge. It's really convenient that Mayor Wirtz is here today because he's one of the instrumental people in arranging a fairly significant private and public land swap to allow us to build our facility where it is. We're located on the site of the former Spinard community dump. It's an area that was closed down when the big merger took place many years ago. And it was a perfect site to build parking. With dumps, you have methane and other things that preclude you from building very much, but it works for parking. And at a cost of about $12 million to build the entire facility, it includes self-storage and parking for about 1,200 cars. What we sell there is service. People come into our facility, park their vehicle, we pick them up at their vehicle, deliver them to the airport at the curb, and do the exact reverse when they come back. As I was saying earlier today, we're not as convenient as parking at the airport. We charge a little bit less than the airport charges, but what we do is we sell that service. We help you onto the bus, we help you with your luggage, you don't have to drag it through the garage, or if you park in long-term parking and you're half a mile away from, that's an exaggeration, but you're a long way away from the terminal. And we're open 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. We employ between 25 and 30 people, have a payroll of about $500,000. We do business at the airport, we currently are required to have a ramp pass for each vehicle. Those ramp passes have been as high as $1,000 a year. Currently, we're paying $500 a year. We have five of them, and so five buses, so we pay a total of $2,500. In addition to that ramp pass expense, the airport has been seeking a percentage of our gross revenue, and based on our projections for the fiscal year 2006, that would total $120,000 for 2006. And it would be the difference in that year between, you know, being profitable and not. We don't think that's fair. All other businesses that pick up and drop off customers at the airport facilities pay flat fee as a ramp pass. The 8% is the charge that they charge people that are actually located on airport property, and they're trying to extend that to off the property. Diamond Parking realizes that we should pay something. One of the senators asked how they handle it outside, and I can answer that question. It all depends on the airport. There are airports, principally on the East Coast or Midwest, that do charge percentages. 8 to 10% seems to be a typical figure. On the West Coast, we operate in Spokane and Salt Lake City. Spokane charges a flat fee per bus. It's $400, and that's all they do. Salt Lake City charges on a per-trip basis. They also do have a percentage tax that was introduced by the Salt Lake City municipal government to help pay for some park development. But the per-trip fee seems to be the most common one in the Northwest. Both Seattle, Portland, and Salt Lake City charge on a per trip. It's based on the size of the vehicle and the number of passengers that they haul. And to further expand on what Diamond Parking thought that we should do, we felt strongly that we should pay something. We made two proposals back to the airport administration when they first proposed a percentage of business. We proposed a per car cost. Our contention is that while our passengers do use, or our customers do use the airport, they only use it once coming and they use it once going. It doesn't really matter if their car is parked in our facility for 6 days or 6 months. They only use it that one time. So paying a per car into our facility seemed like a valid way to take care of that. The other one was that we did propose a per trip fee for our bus. In Salt Lake City, and we use that as an example, each vehicle, each commercial vehicle, has a transponder that's mounted on their bus that identifies their bus. They go out to the facility. They're designated to go through a particular lane to pick up passengers. And they approach a gate. The transponder identifies the vehicle. The gate goes up. They record it. At the end of the month, each commercial facility is then presented with a bill that says your buses went through 500 times, you owe us X amount of dollars. What we did was we proposed that we would actually fund the installation of that equipment and deduct our fees from that cost of installation until we broke even, and then we'd pay. Being in private enterprise, we thought that that's not a bad idea. Salt Lake City, again, using that example, charges everybody from taxi cabs to large passenger buses a varying rate. We thought that the airport could then expand their revenue base and probably end up with a pretty healthy amount of money. Both of those proposals were rejected. And so therefore, since we've been doing, you know, we've been trying to get this solved for several years, the natural progression was to try to have the legislature help us, and that's why we're here.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Neely? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As we look at this bill, one of the things that comes to mind is, there, are you being singled out, or are there other entities out there that are going to be having to have their books looked at for 8% of their gross revenues?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that's a hard question to answer as such. But what I would say is that we are the only one that's involved in off airport parking in this manner. So to me, it looks like we're targeted. The airport has stated that anybody else that's engaged in what we do will be gone after. But I've seen nothing that says that that's actually going to happen. There are several hotels in the Spinard area of Anchorage that actually provide a certain number of parking stalls for what they classify as good customers, whether they're people that work up on the North Slope or just people traveling out of town, that you stay a night in their hotel, they will let you park there for however long your trip is going to be. You come back, you pick up your car, and you go home. So if indeed the airport went after these other businesses, then I guess the answer would be no, they're not singling us out, but it doesn't seem like they're addressing them
Thank
with
you,
the
Madam
same
Chairman.
Tenacity.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at this chart here. This appears to be the state law and how we categorize today. So is the effect of this bill then that we're moving off-premise, off-campus parking from off-airport shuttle to off-airport car rental? Where's our bill sponsor? Could we have Senator Cowdery's staff come back?
Senator Wilkin, through the chair, if you could repeat that real quick for me.
This table?
Yeah.
Okay. Is the effect of this bill that we're moving off-campus parking facilities with valet service from currently off-airport shuttle to off-airport car rental?
Actually, off-airport car rental on this fee is the proposed fee currently, and that's what we're trying to avoid. We're trying to move off-airport, I'm sorry, I was reading that right. You're correct. What they're doing is they're moving off-airport valet parking services into that off-airport car rental parking structure or structure for fees. That's what the intent of the proposed regulation is. The intent of this bill is to keep off-airport valet parking out of that same group. Basically, they would stay within a shuttle service. And actually, we don't specifically, in this bill, doesn't specifically say what fee structure that off valet parking has to fall into. Oh. It just says not to treat it vastly different than the others and put it with off-airport car rental.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, I understand. So in early 2005, DOT said, we think you should be diamond parking and others, you should be off-airport car rental. Mm-hmm. This bill keeps you in off-airport shuttle.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, that's correct.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Did someone else have your hand up? Okay, thank you. We have a couple of people online who have signed up. Dan Coffey and Sherm Ernoff.
Hello, yeah, Dan Coffey here. How are you all?
Morning.
I'm an attorney for Diamond Parking, and I know most of you over the years. I thought I'd give you a little historical context because I was in the car rental business until December of this last year, 05, when we sold our dollar rent-a-car business. Several years ago, there was an effort by the airport to impose a percentage of the receipts on the car rental business. And at that time, dollar was an off-airport parking, and we gathered the other off-airport parkers and stopped that bill. And the rationale behind it was, at the time, it did not seem appropriate to impose these kinds of percentage charges based on the use of the airport. It seemed to be a more appropriate thing to do to have the charge for the shuttle bus, either a flat annual fee or a per charge, and the airport at that time went to per flat annual fee. Subsequently, dollar moved on the airport, and the airport went back to the regulatory scheme and imposed this percentage on the off-airport guys, but the level and the volume of business associated with those off-airport operators and what they get from the airport is so de minimis that they have prescribed a flat fee as well, $250 or a percentage of the gross. My information is that they pay the flat fee and no more. And frankly, this is the off-airport rental car guys are real, real insignificant in the airport leisure tourism market. So they're relatively insignificant. As far as I know, they're the only ones who are subject to this type of percentage of the gross. When this diamond parking facility came into being, and I was the attorney when the land swaps and all of that stuff were done at the assembly level that resolved some neighborhood issues and gave Diamond the opportunity to build their parking facility on the old city dump and make use of land that was otherwise unusable. When all this came down, what the airport found is that it wasn't able to make as much money. So rather than, at least in my judgment, rather than getting into the business of effectively competing with Diamond Parking by doing something with long-term parking and some other things that could be done, they went after the percentage of the income of Diamond Parking, and it's a huge fee for use of the curb. And our objections have been twofold. Number one, they've been based on the existing statute, the one that says fees for the privileges or services that are reasonable and uniform for the same class. And the second thing has been an argument with the airport, which is this. The airport says that but for the airport, Diamond Parking wouldn't exist. And therefore, they're using the whole airport. And therefore, it's appropriate for us to get into their pants pocket to the tune of 8% of their gross receipts. We don't buy the but-for argument at all under the existing statute because of the language in there that says, the terms, conditions, and so on of the fees shall be established with due regard to the property and improvements used and the expense of operation to the state. Now, you know, we're using the curb, basically. So why would Diamond or anybody else, any hotel shuttle service or, you know, any other service, have to pay a fee based on the entire cost of the airport under the but-for argument? Unfortunately, this argument has fallen on deaf ears, I think primarily because the driver here is to make up for lost parking revenue from the parking garage that the airport has and the fact that their long-term parking is located I think in Mr. Neely's words, a half a mile away, which I will also acknowledge is an exaggeration, but it's a tough place to get from there to the terminal. So what we find is we've been in a two-year-long battle with these fellas, and now we're at the point where we've got an administrative appeal going on. And we thought, look, this type of charge imposed by a civil airport on private off-airport businesses is just inappropriate. It's inappropriate for Diamond. It's bad public policy, and we are going to proceed and ask for some legislative change to make it absolutely clear what, frankly, I think is already pretty clear. And then hopefully the airport will establish reasonable, uniform charges for this type of service and get its revenue appropriate to the use by the individuals. And that's really what we're after here. Treat us the same as everybody else and establish fees that are commensurate with the amount of property used. And if they do that, they're not going to have any problem with us or anybody else. And so we ask that the changes be made to protect against this type of behavior, which I've seen twice in 10 years, and put the airport on notice that the way you do it is a much more appropriate and fair manner. So I'm free to answer any questions, and I thank you all for your time.
Are there any questions for Mr. Coffey? Thank you, Dan, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. John Torgerson.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning, Senator.
Members of the committee.
You can give your name and who you represent, please.
John Torgerson, Deputy Commissioner DOT for Aviation. So today's role is to answer questions and to give a little testimony on the bill on behalf of the airport.
Go right ahead, sir.
First of all, this is not a new issue as far as airports are concerned across the United States. The off-airport percent methodology was tested in our Supreme Court sometime in 1988, a different airport than here, but it went to the U.S. Supreme Court on whether or not this is something that the methodology was legal under the equal protection and other things. So there are other airports around the United States and probably the world that use this kind of methodology. So I didn't want the committee to think that Anchorage and Fairbanks are, in fact, imposing something that's not used at other places. As most of you know, our agreement with the airport system does about a $65 million system to operate. The agreement we have with the airlines is called a residual agreement, whereby the signatory airlines pay all the expenses and obligations of the airport system through the airport and the state acting as leaseholders. And terminal rents and other things, and then any part that's deficit from what you could collect from tenants receiving fair market value for what you have there is passed on to a landing fee or made up or equalized through a landing fee that is charged to all the airports. I find this, the fiscal note said it's zero impact to the department. It's actually just a shift of monies between tenants and other users of the airport to the signatory airlines or through the methodology I just explained on how the airport basically breaks even for their operating cost in a year. This has been characterized as a government versus private sector issue, and actually when you understand the residual agreement and how we collect all the operating expenses through the signatory airlines and others, this is really a private sector versus private sector with the state acting as the collector of the revenue. I will just put on the record that the expenses of the airport, you're all familiar with the reconstruction of the sea terminal. We just are closing on bonds, I believe today, for the reconstruction retrofit of A and B terminals, the $176.8 million. $90 million for Fairbanks, and we also have rental car bonding issue that you approved a couple of years ago that is currently under construction. They're starting the dirt work in Anchorage to the tune of $65 million, which would affect rental car agencies if they were to move off airport. As far as this being new to Diamond, it was in 95, the regulations that were talked about, proposed regulations, they were actually adopted in 95, I believe in June or July of 95. And it is true that this is now a subject of an administrative appeal. And I believe because of that, a lot of the parties basically got to a point where they could agree to disagree and decided to take it to administrative appeal. My understanding is that the We're in the process of selecting a hearing officer to hear this on the merits of whether or not it's constitutional, so forth, to collect that fee. I did bring this up to the airlines. The airlines just recently have an airline affair meeting that were attended by about 14 or 15 of the signatory airlines. We do have 25 airlines that are part of the residual agreement, and we have 35 other airlines that service the Anchorage Airport. The airlines indicated that they would be writing letters and getting hold of members, but our meeting was last week, and they probably haven't had time if you don't have any on record. Again, this has been tested in courts in several jurisdictions as far as the legality of it, and it has been found to be, because of the revenues and operating expenses of an airport and loss of revenues, as someone had mentioned, to the airport, these classes, they're creating a class and charging 8% to that class is found to be constitutional. There is someone also, these are just notes that I made through the testimony, but there is a loss of revenue to the airport. I think Senator Bundy asked that question. It's the fiscal note is kind of split between the loss of revenue that we would get with the 8% and the loss of revenue that the airport experiences, although I believe it's a little higher than what might have been originally thought there. The sponsor stated that this was treats everyone equally, but it actually looks to me like it just takes away our opportunity to charge gross revenue, which I understand is not really what is being debated. It's really how much should be charged instead of whether or not what methodology used to reach a certain number, whether or not it's 100,000 or some other number. This eliminates the gross revenue methodology to use, but not others. I think also the question of whether or not this was covered by federal law, and it, other than the FAA and our grant assurances at the airport that we charge to fair market value to as much as possible make airports revenue neutral. We have that on all the airports in the state that we have grant assurances on or have used federal money to build the airport. Another issue was, would the maintenance go up if folks move off? And on the surface, the answer would be no, but once the rental car facility is built, and I don't know of any rental car agencies that are thinking about moving off the airport, but if there were, then the amount of money that would cost to maintain that facility and to pay the bonds, the $65 million, would be divided amongst those remaining users of that facility, and those that choose to move off could do so without having that obligation. And again, I don't know of anybody that is thinking, any of the rental car agencies that are thinking of moving off the airport. But as we know, things we put in statute last until change, so this could be years down the road. This is Diamond being singled out. They're the only, that I'm aware of, the off-airport parking that has been charged. And it is true that the folks at the airport are looking at some of the other, like hotels and things close by the airport that are advertising that they are providing off-airport parking and at a fee. We have been collecting off-airport rental car. Actually, the first information that I have in my file is the regulations were adopted, it looks like, 1994. And the fiscal impact I look at is it only goes back to 2004 with some enterprise, for example, Value Car, USave, others that were Anchorage Nissan and affordable, have been paying 8% for a while. I guess just in wrap up, Madam Chairman and members of the committee, this is not necessarily a new 8%. It's not just coming down the pike. We because Diamond's here, has been something that's existing. The airlines, since we're dealing with international and national airlines, they are very familiar with residual agreements as they have them in a lot of airports, and also this issue of rental cars, and their position is that we're signed on for the risk of, in this case, about $600 million of bonds and other things for the airport, and obligated to the residual agreements for the operating expenses of the airport, and as much as possible, all users should pay equal to others that are using the airport. We currently have six classes, I believe is what I was told, five or six classes of shuttles or entities that are using the airport, and each class is treated equally amongst that class. So with that, Madam Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I do have the property director here with me, John Barcelo, for the Anchorage International Airport. So any real technical type questions, then we can call on Mr. Barcelo.
Other questions for Deputy Commissioner Senator Torgerson? Senator Bundy.
Yeah, where's my $2?
this weekend, sir.
Yeah. Well, if you get this increase, maybe you can, never mind. I have some empathy for airlines. They're in tough times now. And if indeed the airport has to generate more income, why doesn't the airport consider changing everyone to the 8% gross rather than just the off-car parking, off-airport parking and off-airport rental car?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, I would assume you mean all the shuttles and all everyone that drives up to the airport?
Yeah.
Again, that's a good question. I can only imagine when they created the different classes prior to me being on board with this, they recognized the uses of the airport, the uses of the facility, other indicators such as maintenance and other things that might be used, and upset and loss of revenue to the airport, and set their fees accordingly.
Senator Torgerson, Mindy just handed me a note that says Senator Torgerson needs to remember his old practice. So, are you for or against the bill? Apparently, you asked that question a few times.
The department, on behalf of the airlines, is opposed to the bill.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Are there other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator Torgerson, thank you for coming out this morning to go ahead and answer some of these questions that I certainly have had for a long period of time dealing with the airports throughout the state, as well as, and I must declare that I am a subscriber to airport leasing, so there may be a conflict here, but there's people within my district that certainly have got issues with the state. I would like to go back, though, to Senator Bundy's question about 8%, and if you're going to be charging 8% of the gross revenues to some of these businesses that are out there, why not charge 8% of what Northwest pays to come into Alaska to pay their fair share?
Well,
I guess obviously the point is,
Senator Olson, we're currently in contract negotiations with the signatory airlines.
Sure.
And I don't know what percent they pay. Well, I do. I don't have it in front of me right now. But, of course, they pay the airlines pay 100% of $65 million or whatever the operating cost is, which, again, will go up as soon as these bonds, the bond payments hit the landing fees. And so they do pay. The largest payer that I can remember right now is Alaska Airlines at Anchorage Airport, and they pay 12% of the total operating cost of the airport. But I can get you that information. It's certainly public information, and we have it broken down by revenues per airline.
Senator, it's not my intent to go ahead and point that out. Obviously, 8% of what the gross revenues that Northwest Airline does, or FedEx, or somebody like that, that's one of the bigger operators out there. The biggest, obviously, Alaska Airlines is totally like looking at apples, comparing apples and oranges. But I would like to go ahead and look at another aspect of this, which is down to a smaller scale. If you're going to charge an entity that's off airport parking or give shuttle service Let's say that we go ahead and proceed on, and we want to go ahead and look at other businesses that are going to be charged for their shuttle service. Let's look. Are you planning on charging Millennium Hotels 8% of their gross revenues for providing parking there as well?
Olson, that is in a different class, and that class is being charged a ramp fee or whatever. I'm not exactly sure what it is for bringing their vehicle on to the airport. But no, there's no intention of charging them a gross fee.
Okay, and the other question is
parking. Excuse me, John just telling me for parking there is, but not for hotel room.
Okay, at least the concern that I have here is that as we're looking at some of the issues that have been brought up, you talked about the bonds and the stuff that were being sold to go ahead and put up the expensive portion of the terminal. I just see this as something that you're asking the successful businesses to go ahead and pay for cost overruns and over budget problems that have gone on with the terminal over the last number of years prior to Mike coming on board here. And I don't think it's fair for small businesses to be out there to pick up these issues that were none of their concern.
Chair, Senator Olson, this is really little to do with cost overruns or construction costs. This is operating. It is true that the bonds themselves are integrated into the landing fees and to the other fees that the terminal, the people who lease in the terminal, I believe that they're going to go to $52 a square foot that they're in the terminal when all the bonds and all this hit the terminal rates. Like I said, this is an equalization thing. They would just assume that other people that have the same amount of benefit that the airport provides would, in fact, pay the same as they might get for the same benefit. In this case, the clearest example is rent-a-cars, but if you got $65 million for rent-a-car and the expense for doing that, and you move off the airport, then somebody's hung up with $65 million to pay for that and the operating costs.
I can understand.
The leasees within the airport, rent's going up, I wouldn't say double over this, but a pretty substantial increase to pay for the construction costs, as would the 8%, of course, is 8% of what's actually happening, and the rental cars on the facility are paying the same or 8 or 10% is what John just told me for that will go into.
I still think you're mixing apples and oranges, though, Senator. You're dealing with off-airport entities that have little or no wear and tear on the facility, and you're as opposed to those that are not just using the terminal area on the unsecured side. You're also bringing in the people that are dealing with the secured side of the airport. But let's just go on. One of the things that my last question, Madam Chairman, if I could. Let's just go on just to say that you have any idea how many businesses are affected by this 8% gross revenue as opposed to those that are not? And I guess one of the real concerns that I have is there's obviously airports up in my area that I represent that are dealing with on-airport businesses and providing services out there, as well as other commodities, but they're being charged 8% of their gross revenues, and I think that those of us that are in business, especially here at this table, you know, it's going to be an IRS, if an IRS audit is going to be there, they better have a warrant before I want to open up my books to some outside entity to see if I'm telling, to see what my books are showing.
Well, Senator Olson, far-reaching, it is true that we charge by federal law, we are required to charge fair market value on airports and airport leases across the state of Alaska, anything that we have grant assurances on. There are different ways to get to reach that, from a flat fee to fair market value to a percent of gross and different things, which as long as the goal is to reach that fair market value as far as the federal government is concerned, they are okay with different methodologies you might apply, which might be the 8% of gross or something else. It's this bill actually, I didn't think about it as far as how it affects the situation that you and I talked about with Nome, but I don't believe it has any effect at all since it's off airport parking, and that's a sublease agreement up there. So I don't know what else to tell you. I guess that's the state over the years has used both a percent of gross and flat fees to have their lease payments made for whatever the customer is using.
My last question, Madam Chairman, and I guess the point I want to make.
Question.
That was the last bill, Madam Chair. This
no.
Senator Torgerson, as we look at the airport situation where we've got the pizza man up there just trying to provide pizzas to Bush, Alaska, and he's operating out of some rundown terminal that's older than when I was, not older than me, but older than when I've been in the aviation industry, and you compare that to this off-airport business, I don't see the relevance between the two.
Well, Madam Chairman, Senator Olson, I don't know how to answer that. We use the 8% all over across the state, from ADAC to Dutch Harbor to Barrow to Nome. So they're not the pizza delivery guy being out here. That's something the state's been doing for a number of years.
So, for example, Ken's restaurant up in Barrow pays 8%.
I'm not sure.
Well, I'll tell you what they're paying. They're not paying anything because the terminal burned down in December. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We'll give them a refund then for December.
Thank you,
Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. I get the sense there are some questions that need to be answered. We will have this first thing Thursday morning to pass out. Anyone has any other questions, get your questions answered. If you have any information you need, let me know, and we'll pass it out first thing Thursday morning. And we have arranged to be a little bit late for our 11 o'clock meeting, and so we will go ahead and hear Senate Bill 250. I think Pat Davidson and Tom Maher are supposed to present. Thank you, gentlemen. And this is the Domestic Violence Sexual Assault Council. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Tom Maher. I'm staff to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, Senator Jean Theriault Chair. Of course, with us today is the Legislative Auditor, Pat Davidson. On the behalf of the committee, I thank the Senate Finance Committee for hearing Senate Bill 250 relating to the termination date of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault and eliminating references to the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. In this sunset review on page 7 of the report, the legislative auditor concluded that the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault continues to serve a public purpose and a public need and is operating in the public interest. Accordingly, Section 3 of the bill extends the sunset date for the Council from June 30th, 2006 to June 30th, 2014, which is an 8-year extension. The audit also addressed some ongoing operational concerns, including staff turnover and failure of the Council to address statutory mandates regarding the working with the Department of Education and Early Development and school districts on curricula on the cause, prevention, and treatment of domestic violence and sexual assault, and also coordinating with the Department of Health and Social Services on the delivery of services to the victims of domestic violence by health care facilities and other providers. These are ongoing issues, and the Council is working to resolve them, and the auditor noted that in her report. The rest of this bill in Sections 1 and 2 address the other recommendation which was directed to the legislature, and that is that the legislature amend the Council statutes related to the governor's 3 appointments of Council members. Those are the public appointments that he makes. Current law requires the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, a nonprofit corporation, to submit a list of recommended candidates to the governor for appointment when a vacancy occurs. Further, statutes require that the governor fill any unexpired term of a council member after consultation with the network. The network annually receives a grant from the council for a legal advocacy project And the appearance of conflict exists when a council member reviews, evaluates, approves, and monitors a grant to the same nonprofit organization that may have been responsible for recommending that that individual be appointed to the council itself. Senate Bill 250 deletes both statutory references that can produce this appearance of conflict. Let's see. Pat Davidson's here, certainly to answer more questions about the conflict. The Senate Health and Social Services Committee considered this legislation and passed it with no changes. Finally, there is one fiscal note from the occupational licensing, and as you're aware, passage of this legislation will incur no additional cost beyond what is already in the governor's FY 07 operating budget, and the board is self-supporting. With that, Madam Chair, we're here for questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions of either Tom or Pat Davidson? Pat, anything further you want to add?
No, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder if she could briefly discuss the conflicts.
Certainly. Pat, for the record, Pat Davidson, representing the Division of Legislative Audit. The statutory language is relatively soft. Governor is required to accept the list of recommendations from the network. There's nothing in the legislation that requires that the governor select from that list. He's free to select anybody he would like to serve on the council. Our concern has to do with looking at the network being a grantee. We're less concerned about one of the grants that they get as opposed to some of the discretionary grants in the past that they have received. It just would eliminate it. Having a single nonprofit entity in statute that is, I guess, first among equals in terms of making recommendations does not appear to be necessary.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question? Are there any other questions of either Tom or Pat? Thank you. We have some people here to testify, and we'll... let's see. Barbara Mason. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Barbara Mason. I'm the Executive Director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I'd like to take this opportunity to give just a brief overview of what the Council's mission is. Our mission is to implement a statewide system of services for the protection of individuals and families affected by domestic violence and sexual assault. We're a government entity. We're housed in the Department of Public Safety, and we're made up of 7 members consisting of representatives from the Departments of Public Safety, Law, Education and Early Development, Health and Social Services, and 3 public members appointed by the governor. One of our tasks is to distribute and monitor the funds received from the state of Alaska as well as the federal government and disperse them out to the programs. We also administer the state certified batterer intervention programs, and we use a proprietary database to capture information from funded CDVSA programs in order to comply with the data requirements from our funding sources. I'd like to say that the council supports Senate Bill 250 as is written, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Peggy Brown. Go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Senate Finance Committee. My name is Peggy Brown. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. We are, as you have heard, a nonprofit statewide organization representing over 20 member programs across the state. The network has a viable working relationship with the council and the council board. We always have historically. And As you know, that board is comprised of four appointed members from state departments and three public members. Now, neither the council nor the network have, when this legislation first came to being, neither one disputed the value of having the network provide a list of nominees to the governor for those public seats. You, in testimony in Senate Hess, the commissioner of public safety himself said, and I quote, as a matter of practicality, the governor should consult with the network before appointing public members to CDVSA, unquote. We believe we should remain in statute. It is important to note two things. One, the governor is in no way, shape, or form bound by any recommendation that we make. In fact, of the last five recommendations we have made, two have been selected. Secondly, in addressing first among equals, we are first among equals. We are the experts in this field for the state of Alaska. We are the voices of the victims, people that we serve. And we believe that we provide a service to the governor in that we provide a list of people that we know who are knowledgeable, have expertise, who are not perpetrators, who are probably not sex offenders. There is a screening process that occurs from the organization which represents those agencies that are on the streets, that are in the lives of domestic violence and sexual assault. If there wasn't that screening process, you know, there are all kinds of situations that could occur, but you could have people, which happens now, just nominate themselves to be on the council. What we have done has been a service. We assure a screening process. We are the expert. When we look for people to recommend on the public seats, we look for adequate representation of the council. We look for rural members to see if it's overly Juneau or overly Anchorage or overly state worker. We look to see that there's a representative who is either been a victim or survivor of domestic violence and sexual assault. You know, and that person could be an insurance agent, a dentist, a parent. It's not that they have to be someone providing services to victims, but somebody who is definitely acquainted with domestic violence and sexual assault. There are many councils that and boards that require these kinds of things. For instance, you know, the statewide independent living council, who has a person with disabilities, is on that council. So what I think I'm saying to you today is that historically the network doesn't have a problem nominating. The council hasn't had a problem nominating. The governor hasn't said there's a problem with us nominating. It's a technicality, as Ms. Davison said. I think it's a very soft, there is soft language. And it's there for a reason. It says the governor may consult with us. And I've heard rumor just actually today that the governor's having trouble appointing occupational licensing therapists on a board because there's no one to make the recommendations. So we would support that the network remain in statute and provide that service of nominating public members to the governor.
Thank you. Are there questions for Peggy? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Am I correct to assume that you are against the bill?
Senator Olson, through the chair, yes, we are against the bill in terms of it removing the network from statute, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Peggy.
Thank you.
Brenda Stanfield? Did you wish to testify? Okay, thanks.
I wasn't I wasn't sure at the time, so.
Okay, that's
it. Open-ended. Brenda Stanfield. I serve two roles here today. I'm the executive director of the Interior Alaska Center for Nonviolent Living in Fairbanks, and then I also serve as the chair of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I won't repeat what Peg said. She said it very eloquently. We didn't want to take up your time here, and each one of us come to the table to say the same thing. So I'll just say that Peg was speaking for all of us sitting in the room. We thank you for making time to hear this bill today. And we do feel that it's so important that the victims are heard on the council. And because the council is not specifically designed to say exactly who the three public members are, that is the role that the Alaska Network has taken on. So we would ask that if you do consider this leaving in statute that the network is being taken out, that you would consider amendments to make sure that the three public members are very clearly defined, that who they are and who they represent, to make sure that the makeup of the council is adequate to hear the voices of the victim and do what they're set up to do statewide. So thank you.
Are there any questions for Brenda? Thank you, Brenda, for being here with us today and representing your cohorts. I wanted to speak to the council and kind of the, in the, be sure in the recommendations mentioned on pages 9 through 11 there that we hear in future that these things are being implemented and that progress is being made, and I'm sure it's your intention to do that, but I'd kind of like to be informed of what's going on to follow through with the auditor's recommendations. And I know some of those are a little fuzzy to get your hands on, and some of them have to do with someone else's responsibility that I think you get to be the catalyst for. So if we can see that follow through, that would be a good thing. Are there any other questions? Senator Wilkin, can I have a motion on the bill?
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair, I move that we report Senate Bill 250 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Thank you. Is there any objection? Senate Bill 250 moves from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal note. There will be no meeting tomorrow morning. However, we will be meeting at 3:30 in the afternoon for the key campaign presentation here in Senate Finance. So is there anything to come before? Do you need any, you need a recess to come back for anything, Senator Wilkin?
No, ma'am.
Nothing, thank you. We are adjourned.